brave, put the bomb on a shovel. He'd walked right through Government House, which is quite big, and he'd put it in a sandbag pit, and it was striking 12, and it went off 3 minutes after he'd put it in with the most sickening explosion that broke all the windows outside of the house.
Neophytus Sophocleus became a wanted man and was taken to the mountains to join the guerrilla bands under AOKA commander Colonel George Grivas.
The anti-terrorist campaign in Cyprus reaches a new stage with the combing of 400 square miles of mountain forests in the southwest of the island. Somewhere in the thick forest in front of them are AOKA leaders with a big price on their head, including, it is believed, the chief of them all, George Grivas.
One British patrol stumbled across Grivas washing himself in a mountain stream, but he escaped and went underground. For the next 2.5 years, he directed his war from this house on the outskirts of Limassol. Under the kitchen sink was the entrance to a cleverly concealed hideout. Not even his area commander knew where he was. But from this refuge, Grivas dispatched orders to his execution squads in the towns.
Metaxas Square, Nicosia, and a surprise swoop by men of the 3rd Parachute Battalion searching for concealed weapons. The day before, in a nearby street, two Royal Air Force men were brutally murdered and one seriously wounded by terrorists. The men, wearing civilian clothes, were shot from behind in cold blood.
If they give me the guns, and everything that they got, we can fight face to face. I mean, we feel brave as they are, I mean, at that time. But they got everything on their side, and they wanted us, I mean, to come and fight with them face by face. How we can fight face by face?
A search was started immediately while the scent was still fresh, but no trace was found. The town is now out of bounds to servicemen off duty.
First task was to get the information to find AOKA. The killers melted into the population, and the people knew what AOKA would do to a traitor.
The hideout living, and I decided and I executed him.
What did you say to him?
Nothing.
What happened?
I didn't go by myself personally. I sent some boys to kill him. He was shot in the head, dead. No explanation, no messing, no... If you're a traitor, you have to die. That's all. It was clear to all of us.
Harding set out to strengthen the police, now thoroughly infiltrated by AOKA. So he created an auxiliary police force, recruited from the 20% minority in the population, the Turkish Cypriots.
We were against AOKA. Britain was against AOKA. Therefore, we had a joint interest in seeing that AOKA did not succeed.
As the Turks were recruited as Britain's law enforcers, they also became the targets of AOKA gunmen. Some said it was deliberate, set Greek against Turk, and divide and rule.
We couldn't bring a whole horde of policemen from elsewhere in to do duties of that kind. And so really, we had no choice in the matter.
Harding introduced tough emergency laws. He punished whole villages with collective fines and curfews. Troops and police rounded up suspects, and thousands were detained without trial. But suspects had to be made to talk.
They took me to a special branch. They took off all my clothes. They tied me by the back, my hands in back, at my foot, and they beat me for a lot. Then they asked, somebody came, a Cypriot came, Onisiphoros, who started beating me. He was always either drunk or taking drugs. He was really mad with me. He was crying one time. He was laughing the other time. I mean, he was a man unbalanced. He was taking a stick to put in my bottom. He was taking some clothes, put it in the water, and then put it in my face so that not to breathe. He was he threw me down and he started dancing on my stomach with. He was wearing boots.
Nikos Kosice described 12 days of torture before interrogators abandoned efforts to make him talk. Many Cypriots made similar allegations of torture, and Athens Radio broadcast every charge. In Britain, the Labour Party demanded an inquiry into these allegations of brutality, but the government stood by Harding.
I had sufficient confidence in my senior police officers and army commanders to accept their view that this didn't happen.
Harding believed he had a more effective way of making the Cypriots talk. In November 1956, he introduced the death penalty for anyone caught with a weapon. Interrogators could now bargain with suspects for information or their lives. Harding's methods started to produce results. Hooded informers led British soldiers to Ayoka hideouts. As Ayoka's leaders were captured one by one, Grievous's second-in-command, Gregoris Avsentiu, told his men that he would never surrender. A fight to the death would restore Ayoka's support. In March 1957, British troops discovered Avsentiu's hideout in a cave high in the Troodos Mountains. So confident were the British that they invited newsreel cameras to film this important capture. The battle raged for 6 hours as Avsentiu and his aide Matrosos fought it out with British soldiers. The British became impatient. They poured petrol into the cave and set fire to it.
I was in front of the exit and the flame took me from the face. Instantly, I covered my face, my eyes, and my hands also bad. I feel bad. I turn again to the exit view. I saw him in flames. And he shot me, "Don't be afraid." It was the last word I heard from after you. I jumped over the cave with the hope that a bullet will, somebody will shoot me. I didn't want to live, and I didn't want to die by flames.
Matrosos was found lying stunned at the bottom of the hill.
They removed some stones from the roof and they saw that it was burned.
The movement had found its martyr. Though Ayoka's mountain gangs had been destroyed, the Greek Cypriots had demonstrated the will to fight on.
I don't believe myself that you can destroy an organization of that kind, which is led by fanatics and has a great deal of support from the civil population, either from sympathy or from fear. I don't think you can destroy it, but we had inflicted a very serious defeat on them.
Harding's forces were now in command, but no new leaders had come forward to replace Makarios and speak for the Greek community. Politically, there was a stalemate. By the beginning of 1957, Britain was reeling from a blow which changed her attitude to Cyprus and to her whole empire. Sir Anthony Eden's attempt to reconquer the Suez Canal had ended in disaster, and he had resigned. His successor, Harold Macmillan, though an imperialist in style, was a realist in practice, and thought the whole of Cyprus was no longer needed. A small base would do. But if the British wanted to negotiate, they would have to talk to the Archbishop. He was released from detention, but forbidden to set foot in Cyprus. On the 17th of April, 1957, Makarios arrived in Athens to a hero's welcome. The release of the Archbishop angered Turkey, which already feared a British withdrawal. The colonial secretary, Lennox Boyd, had visited Ankara to suggest there was a way to protect the Turkish Cypriots when the British pulled out.
And when that happened, the Turks in Cyprus would be as entitled as the Greeks in Cyprus to have their own self-determination. And that, of course, would then involve the partition of the island.
I remember maps drawn in blood with the Turkish flag on top of it. Partition became the cause célèbre, as they say at the time. Partition or death became the slogan.
Makarios refused even to come to talks if Turkey were represented. Macmillan wrote in his diary, "It really is one of the most baffling problems I can remember." The solution he hit upon was a new governor, not a soldier, but a conciliator, Sir Hugh Foote, Michael Foote's brother and a known friend of the Greeks.
On taking up his appointment as governor 4 weeks ago, Sir Hugh was asked to make his report on the troubled island. Since then, at great personal risk, he has toured Greek and Turkish villages, seeking the views of the people themselves.
I said at the time I was rather pleased with myself. Things had gone rather well. I got a good deal of publicity from these acts, no great substance perhaps in them, but they were indications of an anxious anxiety to work with the people. And then the terrible consequence.
Foote's friendly to the Greeks only convinced the Turkish Cypriots their protectors had abandoned them. On the night of the 7th of June, 1958, the peaceful coexistence of the two communities ended forever.
There was an explosion at the information bureau of the Turkish consulate. A crowd had already gathered there, a crowd of Turkish Cypriot youth. And they all almost immediately decided that Greeks had done it. And they were swearing vengeance against the Greeks and so on.
The explosion started a night of rioting in Nicosia. Turkish Cypriots burnt and looted Greek shops and houses. Soon, Aoka counterattacked, and the fighting spread around the island. British soldiers put up barricades to keep the two communities apart. Partition was fast becoming a reality, as ordinary people were murdered merely because they were Greek or Turkish. The fighting raged for 3 months. More than 100 were killed. Against this background, Macmillan and Foote tried to launch a new initiative.
The task which the British government has set itself is to see whether we could bring about at least some temporary period of calm and peace in the island. That means a great effort by all concerned.
Macmillan offered to share the governing of Cyprus with Greece and Turkey. On the surface, a generous and even-handed offer. But to the Greeks, to have Turkey installed as a ruler of an island they claimed was part of Greece was a nightmare come true.
The Greek people of Cyprus will oppose by all means the unilateral application. If the British government insists on its plan, the result will be disastrous.
Macmillan warned the Greeks that this plan would be imposed in 2 months' time, unless they compromised.
This time it wasn't a question of going to beg them. Athens and Greece. The idea was that we should go and tell them that we're going ahead with this. You've got to accommodate yourself to it. I think that made a main difference.
In desperation, Makarios turned to the British Labour Party, who had promised to grant Anasis when they won power. He asked Barbara Castle to Athens, but she brought bad news. They too would back the Macmillan plan unless Makarios compromised.
Oh, he's prepared to make a very important change indeed. He has offered to accept the status of independence for Cyprus on condition that Cyprus shall not be linked either with Turkey or with Greece. In other words, he says, rule out partition and rule out union with Greece, and let Cyprus be an independent state whose new position shall be guaranteed by the United Nations. Now, this is a very hopeful new development and offers a way out of the present deadlock.
We were terribly astonished when, out of the blue one day, Barbara Cassi, who was an able woman, came out and said, Makarios has proposed me independence. We remained completely astonished.
Grivas was also astonished. He had not been consulted, and 2 days after the Archbishop's concession, he issued this command. He ordered Aoka to strike at will against the British, soldiers and civilians alike.
It was here in Famagusta that the most brutal outrage of all outrages in Cyprus took place. Two British shot in the back. Mrs. Cutliffe died at once, and Mrs. Robinson was gravely wounded. Both were wives of servicemen. An intensive search for the murderers began at once. It would be surprising indeed if the troops, naturally enraged by this cold-blooded act of Ioka thugs, had carried out their search and made their arrests with kid glove methods. All must surely have felt that this was the most poignant of the many tragedies of the tragic situation in Cyprus.
World opinion was so outraged that Grivas denied responsibility, but Aoka resumed the killing of British servicemen. For the British, it seemed to be getting worse and worse. At the United Nations, the problem was about to be taken out of their hands. Greek Foreign Minister Averof proposed independence for Cyprus as his last chance to defeat the Macmillan plan and to keep Turkey out. Turkish Foreign Minister Zorlu backed the Macmillan plan.
In fact, on Cyprus, there are two national communities.
And at the end of a grueling debate, the Greeks were defeated.
We went with some members of the delegation at the end of a corridor to smoke. And we were frantic, of course, desperate. Because there are also questions of internal policy. How do you go back in the country beaten in an international forum? Then I saw Zorlu coming towards me. I told my people there, he's coming here. I am afraid I'll slap him in the face. I'm so nervous, I don't think I will be able to keep my nerves. So he came smiling and he told me, I came to congratulate you.
To Averof's amazement, Zorlu proposed a deal. Turkey would accept independence for Cyprus if they could agree guarantees to protect the Turkish minority. Over the next few weeks, they worked out the details of their plan. And 2 months later in Zurich, their prime ministers approved their proposal.
Mr. Zorlu, as Turkish foreign minister, are you happy with the agreement you have reached with Greece?
I am completely happy.
Why has it taken so long and cost so many lives before this agreement was reached?
This is rather a difficult question, because the matter was a very complicated one, and the national pride and too much emotion was involved in this dispute.
Averof and Zorlu flew straight to London, where the British Foreign Secretary, Selwyn Lloyd, was delighted with a solution that let Britain escape from Cyprus and yet retain two military bases. The leaders of the Turkish and Greek Cypriots were then invited to Lancaster House to ratify these proposals. This conference was to be only a signing ceremony. Details agreed in Zurich could not be changed, and Makarios had promised Greek Prime Minister Karamanlis that he would accept the deal.
Outside Lancaster House, even the fog was lifting as Foreign Secretary Selwyn Lloyd arrived for the conference on Cyprus. To the governor of the island, Sir Hugh Foote, it was a near miracle that the hope of peace had dawned at last. Indeed, the presence in London of the much-discussed Archbishop Makarios, now indisputable fact, would have seemed quite out of the question only a week or two ago, yet here he was.
The conference began with each delegate playing his expected role. Selwyn Lloyd read out the Zurich agreements. Averoff described them as the best possible, and Zorlu agreed. Then Makarios spoke. He said that while he accepted the agreements as a basis, he would like just a few amendments. The conference was stunned. Averoff telephoned Karamanlis in Athens, who flew to London and immediately ordered that Makarios be brought to meet him. Makarios said he had promised to sign, but he was sorry. He had now changed his mind.
Then Karamanlis told him very calmly, but in a very strong voice, that I want you to know one thing. My policy on Cyprus is fixed. We have monographed these agreements in Zurich. It's finished, that's the agreement. That's my policy. If you don't agree, I will not change my policy. It's fixed. And he left.
Makarios was given one more night to accept the deal. War or peace in Cyprus hung on his decision alone. If he decided to fight on now, how many Cypriots would follow him?
And that was the most critical evening for the Archbishop. I remember I went to his room and I stayed with him until midnight. And I remember Archbishop was smoking. He was a heavy smoker, smoking and thinking. I told him good night and have a good sleep. And he told me, I wonder if I can sleep this evening. So next morning I went first and knocked his door, and he said, I have already given my answer. I have contacted the Greek representatives and I told them that I will sign. That was the story.
This day, a new chapter opens up for the people of Cyprus, a period of peace and prosperity and freedom. The two communities in the island, working closely together with God's guidance, will, I have no doubt, be able to develop the welfare of the island to their common benefit.
The Cypriots' armed struggle was entirely successful in the military sphere, as history will pronounce one day. However, its accomplishments were duly exploited by the political leadership.
Grivas did not dare clash with Makarios. He reluctantly ordered his men to lay down their arms and went home to Greece. But he was to return later to plague Makarios. The Archbishop moved into Government House as President of the Republic of Cyprus.
After the end of the war? Oh, yeah. I came here just to take my belongings, you know. Before, I telephoned to the ADC and I asked him to give me my salary. He said, are you crazy? He said. And I told him that if he denied to give my salary, I blew him up. He said, come on, the government house belongs to you now, he said.